You're listening to KZYX Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner, and I'm here with my guest, Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, author of The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece and Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity. And now, a little music.
Ooh.
we've been listening to Come to the Altar. That is from my CD, Okwaka Speaks, the words and music of Mother God. My guest this evening is Professor Marguerite Rigoyoso, PhD, author of the groundbreaking books The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece and Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity. She teaches on women and religion at Dominican University of California, the California Institute of Integral Studies, and the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, and delivered a James C. Loeb classical lecture at Harvard University on the cult of divine birth in ancient Greece. Marguerite's pioneering research on female deities and women's religious leadership in the ancient Mediterranean world and beyond has appeared in anthologies and journals, including Feminist Theology, the Encyclopedia of Religion and Nature, Societies of Peace, She is Everywhere, Trivia, and the Journal of Feminist Studies in Religion, where her paper on the cult of Demeter and Persephone in Sicily received an honorable mention for the New Scholar Award. She is also the editor of Where to Publish articles on women's studies, feminist religious studies, and feminist womanist topics. Marguerite was interviewed in the documentary shown at the recent Mendocino Film Festival, The Vanishing of the Bees, about the relationship between bees and the goddesses of antiquity. Greek religion is filled with strange sexual artifacts, stories of mortal women's couplings with gods, the unusual virgin birth stories of Pythagoras, Plato, and Alexander, and more. In this provocative study, Marguerite suggests such details are remnants of an early Greek cult of divine birth, not unlike that of Egypt. Scouring myth, legend, and history from a female-oriented perspective, she argues that many in the highest echelons of Greek civilization believed non-ordinary conception, parthenogenesis, was the only means possible of bringing forth individuals who could serve as true leaders or avatars, and that special cadres of virgin priestesses were dedicated to this practice. Her book adds a unique perspective to our understanding of antiquity and has significant implications for the study of Christianity and other religions in which divine birth claims are central. The book's stunning insights provide fascinating reading for those interested in female inclusive approaches to ancient religion. A blurb on the book from Gregory Shaw, professor of religious studies at Stonehill College. This is an original piece of scholarship that dares to imagine traditions at the foundation of Western culture in an entirely new light. As with any paradigm shift theory, some may challenge Rigoyoso's interpretations, but all readers will recognize that parthenogenesis, as a symbol of profound spiritual perception, could not have received a more articulate spokesperson. One feels in reading her work that she is writing from inside of tradition that we didn't even know existed, and the authenticity of her writing makes it all the more accessible and inviting. And another blurb. For a goddess to be parthenogenetic means that she stands as a primordial creatrix who requires no male partner to produce the cosmos, earth, life, matter, and even other gods out of her own essence. Plentiful evidence shows that in their earliest cults, before they were subsumed under patriarchal pantheons as the wives, sisters, and daughters of male gods, various female deities of the ancient Mediterranean world were indeed considered self-generating virgin creatrixes. This is the first book to explore that evidence comprehensively. Among Marguerite's many subjects of study, tonight we will be discussing what I've just mentioned, along with something else: recreating the Pleiades, our starry virgin mothers, reclaiming Mary's mystery of virgin birth, and women's sacred use of psychotropic substances in antiquity. Doesn't that sound juicy? Welcome, Marguerite. Thank you.
Janie, thanks for having me.
You know, the first question I ask my guest is, what part did your own mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today? How did she influence you?
Well, aside from being a woman who was ahead of her time in her own way, she grew up an Italian-American, Sicilian-American woman in the 60s who was very much constrained by roles. Despite all that, she was a vibrant singer and teacher and reader and thinker and artist. And so I really take a lot from my mother line. I would say that one of the major ways that my relationship influenced me was through her death when I was 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
And that death was an initiation that I didn't recognize until, perhaps 20 years later. And it was really an initiation into the mysteries of Demeter and Persephone, the mother-daughter goddesses who are separated when Persephone is taken into the underworld. And so although it was my mother who was dying and going into the other world, I was taken into my own underworld through the grieving and the many difficult things that ensued in the years after that until I began to understand what I had agreed to on a soul level to experience, and how that was an entry point into the world of these goddesses and thus many other goddesses as well.
So difficult to be so at a tender age to lose your mother.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does mark you in some ways for the rest of your life. It's an initiation that is that you carry with you almost as something visible.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, how did you, grew up on the East Coast?
I did. Yes, in Connecticut, in New York, and then Connecticut, and then Boston after college. And I came to California about 12 years ago to go to school at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and that really began my formal study of the goddesses and women's ancient priestess traditions, something that took me all the way through the PhD level.
Wow. It sounded, though, as if you were had awareness of goddesses before that. Is that true?
Yeah. My awakening to the goddess came when I was 32 years old. I was going to Greece. It came when I went to, in Boston at the time, there was something called the Interface Foundation. It was sort of mind-body courses in the evening. And I began taking courses as a part of my personal healing. And I went to one on women and self-esteem. And the therapist, Greta Bro, who led the seminar, said that women need to understand how deeply wounded their self-esteem has been through growing up in a culture in which God is primarily conceived of as male. And that in order to reclaim self-esteem and heal, one really must look to the goddess roots of all world cultures and begin to reclaim this for oneself. And that began me on a journey to explore the goddess. Synchronistic things happened. I ended up coming to California for a work assignment, and I was able to go to the Gaia bookstore at the time. And they sent me, I asked for books on goddesses, and they sent me books like Maria Gimbutas and Barbara Walker's Encyclopedia of Women's Myths and Secrets, and I began poking in and just having my mind completely turned upside down, or perhaps right side up, finally. But it seemed to confirm much of what I had already intuited about the matriarchal nature of humanity. And from there, I began reading, and then I ended up going to Crete on a goddess tour that synchronistically led me to Athens, where I learned just before the trip that there had been the cult center at Eleusis to Demeter and Persephone just outside Athens. And so it became a whole pilgrimage for me to go and touch into the Demeter and Persephone mysteries on the soil in Greece. And that really very much started propelling me into my own self-directed study of the goddesses, and then also an experiential aspect of going into what does it mean to venerate these goddesses and be involved in ritual surrounding them. And that eventually led me to graduate school.
Wow. Wow. What a journey. It seems as if it was just mapped out clearly, doesn't it?
You know, in retrospect, it does, really. and that I'm still following the path.
Yes, you are. Ever broadening, I might add, it appears.
Yes.
I know that bookstore very well, Gaia Bookstore in Berkeley. I loved that store.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Patrice Wynn.
Yes. Yes.
Really ran that with such dedication for years.
Yes, that's true. And then you found CIIS, and that's...
I did. Yes, it seemed really the natural thing. I thought I might go to graduate school for archaeology, to get a doctorate in archaeology, because I was so inspired by the work of archaeologist Maria Gimbutas, who really has been the major archaeologist to uncover the fact that old Europe prior to 3000 BCE was primarily goddess venerating and had a matrifocal social structure. And I wanted to do more of her work. I wanted to carry out her work, but it was discouraging because I couldn't find any place that could support her work. It's controversial, and some of the women who are archaeologists don't subscribe to her theories and so forth. So I couldn't really do that. So CIIS just emerged as the natural because they have a women's spirituality program, the only place that has a doctorate for it in the world.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Wow.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, so I went there and was able to do the work for my dissertation, which has ended up as my two books, The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece and then Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity. They both are based largely on my dissertation, and then the second one adds about half the book is new.
You're writing, you are speaking, you've come back recently from a trip in Europe.
Yes.
You speak at many conferences, and you're really out there. It's very exciting to see there's such interest in your work.
Yes, thank you. You know, I'm just following my bliss. I'm following what's fun and interesting to me and feels creative and vital. And I just go with my instinct about what's the next step. And of late, the next step was to go to England and then Switzerland. There was a conference on matriarchal politics that I spoke at. And so I created this book tour and speaking, doing workshops and things in England, in London, in Glastonbury, and then in Canterbury. And it was just a wonderful experience, reconnecting and solidifying some contacts that I had made last year when I spoke at Glastonbury at the Goddess Conference, which has been very wonderfully run for at least the past 10 years by Kathy Jones in Glastonbury. Meeting new people and sharing my work, which seems to resonate with a lot of people. It's exciting.
Let's talk about virgin birth. This is a rather unusual concept. I mean, in some regards, how could this be?
Right. You know, it seems an unusual concept, and yet when you think about it, the entire Western civilization and Judaism and Christianity are based on it, not to mention other religions. So it is fundamental, it's at the foundation of our religions, as the way in which these religious, major religious figures from these traditions emerged through being miraculously conceived. And yet, because of our scientific approach to reality these days, science has become a new religion, so-called science, we are not able to open to the possibility of people using their bodies in miraculous types of ways. But what I'm suggesting is that just as many Eastern sages and yogis and so forth are believed to be able to do unnatural things with their bodies, like change their metabolism and eat, you know, live off of air and walk through walls, walk on water, all that type of thing. This virgin birth has been women's practice in this regard for several thousand years, as evidenced in not only the Christian New Testament, but also the Hebrew Bible with stories such as Sarah, other Native American stories, and what I look at in particular is that of the Greeks, the texts of the Greeks, which have very strong beliefs in virgin birth that far predate the advent of Christ. So what I talk about in my books is what the Greeks believed. I don't make any reality claims in my books, although I'm happy to do so in private and in my lectures. But in the book, what I say is that, look, the Greeks believed that. This is enough to say, because this alone has been ignored. But this is a whole religious phenomenon here that bears some investigation, because what is the silence and these veils that have been put over it? That should make us suspect. You know, that should make us suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find is that many, many legendary figures of ancient Greece, as well as several historical figures, as mentioned earlier, Pythagoras, Plato, Alexander the Great, even the Roman Emperor Augustus in the Roman period, were believed to have been born through various types of miraculous means that usually involve a priestess. And usually she is young, just past puberty, just started menstruating. And so I find that there are various periods of these virgin birth practices and beliefs that transformed according to culture, moving from originally its matriarchal underpinnings, meaning that women were at the center of the society, they were in high positions of spirituality and government, and the whole society was built around mothering values. So it wasn't sort of a reverse of what we have now, where women were abusing men. It was really a kind of a healthy culture. But the virgin birth practices seemed to move from what it was under matriarchy to what it was under patriarchy in later stages. And I can explain those stages if you wish, or let me know what...
Mm-hmm.
Where you would like to go with it.
Uh-huh. Well, that might be good to get a brief overview of the stages, yeah.
Yeah, so briefly, what I find is that there was a stage of deep matriarchal culture where it seems that women priestesses were the highest level priestesses who were serving the female deities. The first thing we need to understand is that the female deities themselves, so in the Greek tradition, this would be deities such as Gaia or the Earth, Hera, Athena, Artemis, and so forth, they were understood to be virgin mothers themselves. This would be the substratum of culture prior to the Olympian gods, where these goddesses are made into wives and daughters and sisters of gods.
Excuse me, I'm just wondering, what time period are we talking about?
Well, I can't make any claims in that regard textually, except to say it's definitely in the pre-Bronze Age or pre-1500 BCE.
Uh-huh, good.
If you look at the work of Maria Gimbutas, this would suggest that these beliefs span back into the Paleolithic period, 25 and 30,000 BCE, you know, before the Common Era BC.
Right.
So this original practice was based on the women replicating the abilities of the goddesses they served. And they would conceive parthenogenetically, meaning without male sperm at all, without any kind of interaction with a male entity whatsoever. They would get into a very high trance, tantric state, and they would manipulate or work with their body in order to conceive in this miraculous way, because it was believed that it was only through a miraculous type of pregnancy that a certain type of being could come in, a high, holy level being that was essentially the replica of the deity. In other words, it was an avatar. So in the earliest stage, what I conjecture is that the priestesses were giving birth to female-only avatars, the next generation of priestesses. Because parthenogenesis, theoretically, were a woman to do it, she would only give birth to a female by virtue of the fact that she only has X chromosome. But then there seems to be a later period where you have a series of writings and beliefs stating that a woman could conceive by herself yet a male, and she would bring in a high holy male being. And this seems to be a later stage of the matriarchy, when it seems that something is starting to go on and male gods are coming into ascendancy.
And this when do you think this is about?
Well, you know, Maria Gimbutas really dates the beginning of the Bronze Age to 3000 BCE. This is about when, in the ancient Mediterranean world and North Africa, you start seeing the beginnings of so-called civilization and writing, the beginning of organized warfare. This seems to mark the beginning of patriarchy. So this might have been just before that formal those formal records and the archaeological remains.
Right.
But then, you know, at some point after this, you have a dramatic break, and here's where come in all those stories in the ancient Greek mythology and legends of the young maidens who are getting raped by gods or seduced by gods.
I want to interrupt you one moment to say that this is KZYX at 731, and you're listening to Women's Voices, Janie Reisner, and my guest is Dr. Marguerite Rigoyoso, author of The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece and Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity. So please go ahead.
Yes, so this next phase of virgin birth seems to be when patriarchy is really starting to ascend. We have a phenomenon whereby these women, these priestesses, who once were entranced to give birth to themselves, essentially, or give birth to their double, parthenogenetically give birth, now they are getting invaded in their trance space by the advent of an unbidden male god, who comes in, and there is a sexual encounter that amounts to a rape, a type of a rape seduction, and the women end up with pregnancies as a result of this. This is what I see in the Greek record, that these stories are actually reflective of a cultic phenomenon that happened, or that was believed to have happened. Eventually, the women started acquiescing to this practice and cultivating it, is what I determine. Usually the children of these unions with the gods would be males who would become warrior leaders. So we have the legendary Heracles, Theseus, Perseus, and many, many others. And these legendary heroes go about destroying the matriarchy, if you look carefully at their stories. And they also start dismantling virgin birth, if you look carefully at their stories. And then we have a later period where it seems that the practice of virgin birth, in other words, women's ability to go into a deep trance state, either with herself or with a god, is degenerating. And you now have the advent of these sacred marriages, these hieros gamos, where the priestess now will have sex with a god through a human male. So there's an actual physical sexual intercourse. But it's understood that the human male is getting out of the way so that the god's spirit can come in, and that the pregnancy is the god's child. But this is a later stage phenomenon, and this is what we see described in ancient Egypt as the means by which the pharaohs were conceived and born in the later period. So this is a little bit about the trajectory of what I find in antiquity of how virgin birth, what it was about, why it was present, and how it devolved, essentially.
And I'm just thinking, as you were describing how it was at the end, is very much the Mary, Virgin Mary, that she was impregnated by God.
Right. Virgin Mary is an interesting story because it's a little ambiguous. It's a little ambiguous exactly how her pregnancy happened. There are shades that she might have been impregnated by God, but we don't strongly get that sense. It's almost like she seems like a kickback to parthenogenesis, where the woman was conceiving a male avatar inside of herself without any contact with a male god. So I tend to think that the Virgin Mary's practice falls into that category originally. But what's interesting is that her story is one of many that are in the ancient world, and that, to my mind, doesn't discredit it or diminish it in any way. On the contrary, it shows us that actually it was part of an entire tradition that had been going on with a specific purpose, but also with women as the cultic agents, as the primary empowered agents running the whole show. And that's the piece you really miss in the New Testament, where they make Mary look passive.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, if you look at the infancy gospel of James, which is not considered a real gospel by the Roman Catholic Church, but it is in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, if you look there, you have the whole write-up of Mary's own conception from Anne, which was a virgin birth to begin with, and then Mary's raising and childhood. She was brought to the temple at age 3, to be raised by the virgin daughters of Israel, as they are called. What is that? Well, that's telling us that she was being trained by virgins in this practice of virgin birth from the time she was barely out of infancy.
Hmm.
And the story goes on to tell us that when she was 16 years old, she conceived Jesus. But this was after a long period of practice and practices and training. So what I discover is a whole net and network of priestesses all throughout the ancient Mediterranean world, broadly speaking, of women who were agents of bringing in holy beings to the planet.
Hmm. Well, it's quite thought-provoking. It is.
Yes, because it puts us up against our scientific beliefs, it puts us up against our religious beliefs, and it basically rubs against all of those things. And yet, we have to look at the fact that these stories are foundational. They're not,
mm-hmm.
I'm not making up these ideas. I'm just saying, what is this actually all about? And let's look at this carefully. And when you start laying it all on the table and putting it in categories, it's astounding.
It is astounding. Truly, it is.
The connections.
We're going to open up the phone lines in a little bit, if that's okay with you, so people that can call in. But I'd also like, I'm curious about reconnecting with the Pleiades, our starry virgin mothers, because I personally have such a strong connection to the Pleiades, and I know lots of people who do have that sense of...
Yes. I spoke about this 3 times, twice in England, once on May Day in Glastonbury, once a week later in Canterbury, and then once in San Anselmo, California on June 4th. The reason I have begun speaking about this is because, as one will see if you read The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, my chapter on Dodona, the oracular center of Dodona, where I find a tremendous amount of evidence that there was not only a prophetic priestesshood there, but they were also involved in virgin birth at one point. those women were called Pleiades, which means doves, which is the same word for Pleiades, the seven sisters, the seven stars that you can see. They're a smudgy little asterism. If you look at Orion's belt and look up, you'll see them out beyond Orion's belt as a little smudge. And those seven sisters were conceived of as doves. They were turned into doves by Zeus. They were put among the stars. And there are these stories that these were essentially seven virgin mothers who, through sexual unions with various gods, Zeus, Poseidon, and so forth, gave birth to major, major figures on the planet, including the god Hermes, who really is Tos in the Egyptian tradition, to the founder of Troy and the founder of what became Sparta, as well as several other there are others who were born as well. So in the Greek tradition, as well as cross-culturally, in a way they are the Pleiades. These seven sisters are seen to be the virgin mothers of the world. There are, cross-culturally, they are seen as seven sisters who are very important to humanity, birth large parts of humanity. Many people feel that they've come from the Pleiades. The Cherokee have a belief in this and so forth. Mm-hmm. Many Native Americans have stories of the Pleiades, and they're generally powerful young women just after puberty who sometimes are warriors, and they are all about women's mystery traditions, women's blood mysteries, women's reproductive mysteries, and spiritual elevation, spiritual development. They bring spiritual development to their people. In fact, Standing Elk in the Lakota tradition, I understand he contends that white buffalo calf woman, their major, major sacred female who appeared to them and gave them teachings, he says that she was the youngest of the Pleiades, the youngest of the seven Pleiades. So
interesting.
These stories are networked worldwide. Many people in the West feel an affinity for the Pleiades. They feel that they come from there. And what was the reason I started talking about the Pleiades publicly is because I found a tremendous amount of information connecting the Pleiades to this oracular virgin birth center of Dodona, the oldest known oracle in Greece. The women were called doves, and I make the case that that location was intimately connected with the Pleiades. All the linguistics point to it, and that these priestesses at Dodona were trying to replicate or be like these seven virgin mothers, who were honored because of their celibacy and their virginity, but also for being mothers by virtue of their consorting with various gods. So it's a whole mesh of information that's all together. And again, like the whole what I was talking about virgin birth, when you start laying out the relationships and seeing the threads of how everything's connected, it's quite remarkable. And so what is this, you know, what are the Pleiades saying to us today? There are numerous people who claim to be channeling their wisdom, and Native American tribes have stories and beliefs in them, venerate them. Down in Australia, there are numerous people who believe in them all over the world. The Japanese people who still actually venerate them or run their major seasonal rituals by them, because the Pleiades' heliacal rise in May and their cosmical setting in November marked the beginnings of summer season and the beginnings of winter season, and that was huge for the Greeks. Those were hugely important nodal points of the year, agriculturally and spiritually.
Wonderful. I'm going to interrupt you. I'm Janie Reasoner. My guest is Professor Marguerite Rigoyoso, author of The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece and Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity. And I invite you to call in if you have a question for Marguerite. The telephone number here is 937-5103. If you're out of range, it is 707-937-5103. Something else I am curious about is women's sacred use of psychotropic substances in antiquity. But before you do that, I'm wondering, in your travels and speaking with women in particular, what you see happening regarding the awakening of women generally in the world, and what we're looking at, you know, about the continuing rise of violence against women and girls.
Yeah. I think both things are going on at the same time. There's a tremendous awakening, and yet the way reality in this plane works, there's always an equal and opposite energy activated and acting. So we will be seeing tremendous abuses of women, the trafficking and so forth, rapes and things like that. It's a conundrum that both of these things are happening at the same time. And I think that all one can do is proceed with the awakening of consciousness if one is being called to do that, and it starts with oneself. Because politics will fall into place when people have their own personal relationship with self and others in their immediate environment falling into place. And that is really dependent on deep healing, spiritual opening, spiritual maturity, recognition of one's own shadow elements, and many, many more things.
We have a phone call. Beautiful. Yeah. Good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Hi, good evening. This is fascinating to me. Thank you. My question is if the doctor could talk about if there's any indication as to why there was the women goddesses that allowed the usurpation of their powers is the only word I can think of.
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer on the air, please.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Wonderful question.
Yes. This is a very profound and important question because we want to know what was the origin, so therefore how could we reverse it, and is it possible to reverse it? What I find in my work, I'm basically focused on the Greek deities. In particular, in my second book, Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity, I talk about Demeter and Persephone, and I talk about Persephone's rape by the god Hades in some stories. In other stories, it's actually Zeus, her father. I talk about the Greeks understanding that particular rape story to be sort of like the template or the paradigm for all the rape stories. It was as though that story somehow carried the symbolic resonance of the moment when the back of matriarchy was broken. And it was, this is something very paradoxical to grasp. It was both a violation of the feminine, and it was a choice of the feminine to undergo it. That's very, very difficult to wrap one's mind around. But what I discern is that the impetus for this was generated from the masculine itself, which under a virgin mother universe would have been an emanation of the feminine. The masculine is contained within the feminine. It is birthed out of the feminine. So what I see in the stories is that what happened is the masculine just decided to experiment with its power. It could seem to not be able to resist taking over the universe, taking over the goddesses, subsuming them, swallowing them, that type of thing. And it was through violence always. And it was through a sexual violence, even on the level of the deities themselves. There was a sexual erotic component to this. But it was a violation. They weren't invited to have these types of sexual unions. Once that violation happened, it was a tremendous, there was a tremendous cascading of these energies that happened in the universe, and the earth plane was affected by this. I mean, this is what the ancient stories tell us. The earth plane was affected. Relations between men and women were affected. And so it wasn't really a choice of the feminine to be taken over like this, but at the same time, just as any moment or experience of adversity that we have in our lives, while not welcomed by us, sometimes in retrospect when we look back, really deepens our wisdom, expands our consciousness, breaks us open in some way. So the feminine allowed for this to happen, to see what would happen, to see how she might come out the other side, or how the whole entire reality might come out the other side. What would the whole final trajectory be of this? And I believe we may be in the period, or one of these periods, where we are coming out of this consciously.
Right, and we have another call.
Yeah, the feminine is trying to reemerge and saying, this cycle is concluded. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Hello, you're on Women's Voices.
Hello. This is fascinating. I've been a student of history for the past, going on 40 years. I have one question, and it's this. Do most of these source stories in different cultures worldwide, was this like seven Pleiadian sisters ventured through space, came to this planet, say 20 to 30,000 years ago, and then studied through their natural high essence energy and so forth, conceiving things. And this is what was common in the world till about 5,000 BC, right?
The timelines, there are various timelines given. Did you want to complete your question, or?
That in essence, the source stories of different cultures worldwide from approximately 20 to 30,000 BC to approximately 5,000 BC were the goddesses that came from the Pleiades. Were the creation, the seven sisters, were the ones that created essentially modern life and civilization, agriculture, so forth as we know it. You know, this has been in the matriarchal times prior to the latter times you mentioned.
Okay, there's two things going on here in terms of timelines. One is the accepted timelines that an archaeologist would give. Archaeologists are really only able to go back to maybe about 40,000 BCE cave drawings and things like that. So to their mind, Homo sapiens begins, I believe, around something like 50,000 BCE. There's that archaeological timeline, from most of the earliest, some of the earliest finds are 30,000 BCE in Europe, for example. But there are other stories, other esoteric stories about humanity's origins that do not at all correspond with what the archaeologists are telling us, or even the scientists. For example, Helena Blavatsky, who's the founder of Theosophy, has some remarkably ancient timelines that she claims affect and influence the earth plane and doings throughout the entire universe. So that's one set of esoterics. There are other folks who are channeling about the Pleiades who say that, you know, a lot of this seeding happened, 200,000 and 300,000 BCE from the Pleiades as well as other places. So this is where there's a lot to contend with. I mean, a traditional scholar would, of course, dismiss any of these other so-called knowledge streams, but I'm not a traditional scholar. I'm a scholar who really is interested in non-ordinary ways of knowing, information that comes to us not through books, not through the five senses, that is not bound necessarily to scientific realities and so forth, because I believe we must unite these two ways of seeing so that we can truly have, you know, binocular vision and see more accurately what is the human story, what was going on, how are the Pleiades related, and how is virgin birth related, because this virgin birth story is very, very old. And it far predates Jesus, but it's really sort of at the crux of human implanting.
Mm-hmm. We have another call. This will need to be brief. Good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Thank you for the moment. Have either of you heard of the concept of the Anunnaki?
Yes.
Right. I find that the more I explore that theory, the more that it gains credibility in my factual background of trying to reason this all out. Okay.
The Anunnaki being the Anunnaki, and clarify for me, because I'm just really starting to learn about them, and I agree with you that it's quite interesting. They are supposed beings who came here and seeded humanity to be miners of gold.
Correct.
Okay. So they're extraterrestrial, essentially.
Right.
Entities, okay. Which really, this is when we say the word extraterrestrial, Native Americans say that these are just star beings. We might call them gods, or, you know, anyone who has an idea of the supernatural other. There are all different sorts of words, so we shouldn't let these terms frighten us away from discussing things.
It's just interesting to look at it from as many perspectives as possible.
Absolutely.
Not invalidating one over the other.
No, because if we piece them all together, maybe we're going to get the whole story. This idea of the Anunnaki that came and seeded either humans that were already here or programmed genetically the human strain such that they would be workhorses. Essentially,
well, apparently they combined their genetics with Homo erectus.
Yeah.
Excuse me, just a minute. I'm going to take you off the air. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're getting right down to the end here. Yes.
Okay. There's a lot going on, and it's interesting that your audience is getting into very esoteric topics. Janie, thanks for having me. It's really an honor.
Well, it's our privilege.